Prologue, May 1857. Delicate wood violets carpeted the floor of the white pine forest, but Migasi focused his attention on the broad backs of his father and three uncles. The trip from the North Woods into the more settled areas of west-central Wisconsin unnerved the young brave. But the long-awaited journey would soon be over, and Migasi would finally be reunited with the mother that haunted his earliest dreams. As the trees thinned, the five men tried to remain in the shadows of the hardwoods that still dotted the landscape. But as the party of Ojibwe drew near his mother's settlement, Migasi felt eyes follow him as they passed the fields and farmhouses. He drew alongside his father and quietly asked,
"Imbaba, how much further?"
Hamik sighed and surveyed the area. "All you see belonged to your grandfather, with the tribe's blessing. You know this story, Ngosis."
"Yeah, and my uncles, it belongs to them as well?"
The oldest of his mother's half-brothers nodded his head. "I'm known as White Wolf among our people, but my sister calls me Jean David. I was only 6 when Amik found us, hiding among the caves." His uncle Giwudin interrupted. "Our father roamed these forests and brought a bounty from the land that his people desired. But Pear traded honestly with the tribes, and so they brought him our mother, Kandasa, as a bride." Migasi listened as the men retold the tales of years long past, but his mind was more aware of the sounds of the settlement as they approached Widow's Ridge. The peculiar buzzing and the rushing of water seemed unnatural to him, but the long journey south had taught him several things about his mother's world. As they approached the log-jammed river, a dark bank of clouds began to roll across the western horizon, pushed by a chill breeze that whistled across the fallow fields. Within minutes, a frigid deluge soaked his buckskin leggings, and Migasi pulled a heavy black bearskin over his head and shoulders to protect him from the icy pellets. "This way, Ngosis," Amik directed as they turned southwest, searching for a safe place to cross the river. Ephraim Peterson rushed into the house behind his sons and gave a helpless shrug when his wife noticed the puddle forming at his feet.
"So sorry, Em,"
he apologized, his heavy Norwegian accent still readily apparent more than a dozen years after immigrating to the United States. Tiny hands fisted at her hips, Emmeline's blue eyes sparkled with either mischief or pique. Ephraim couldn't tell. But then his bright beauty laughed and playfully scolded.
"Don't you know how to come in out of the rain?"
Elias and Liam hung their jackets on the pegs near the back door and tried to ignore their parents' affectionate teasing. The boys squeezed past the couple and approached the fireplace with their hands stretched toward the crackling warmth. The volatile spring weather was unexpected after the previous day's summer-like temperatures. Still, the wild crocus and the scent of apple blossoms declared that the blustery conditions were an aberration, a testament to Mother Nature's fickle whims.
"Are those slapjacks?"
Liam excitedly questioned as his oldest sister, Mara, flipped the cornmeal cakes. Melted lard bubbled and popped in the heavy cast-iron skillet, so 14-year-old Mara ignored her rowdy brothers and concentrated on her task. She had no desire to be splattered by the hot grease. But the jostling continued when Floor bustled into the kitchen with Emil and Hendrik toddling along behind like ducklings. Circumventing the crowd around the hearth, Floor hurried to the shelves above the work table and pulled down the butter crock and a jar of Mama's apple butter.
"Is lunch ready yet?"
she chirped with happy anticipation as she set the supplies on the broad plank table. Emil and Hendrik scrambled up onto one of the benches and waited in anticipation.
"Me too! I want some too!"
4-year-old Emil impulsively shouted. Hendrik took up the chant in his squeaky baby voice.
"Ee-oo! Ee-oo!"
Emmeline rolled her eyes and stepped away from the warmth of her husband's body, while Ephraim snickered behind his hand at the look of disappointment on Em's face. Their brood of children certainly brought them great joy, but there were times that the chaos of family life showed up at the most inopportune moments. Case in point, the missed kiss that might have warmed him through with the first touch of his wife's lips. Ignoring the din, Ephraim stepped over to the basin and washed the evidence of morning chores from his hands and face. He gestured for Elias and Liam to do the same when he was finished. As her family settled around the table, Mara slid the last of the slapjacks onto a wooden platter and helped her mother serve the rest of the simple midday meal. Overcast skies left most of the kitchen in shadows, but the dancing firelight was a cheerful reminder of all that God provided in the years since Mara's grandfather explored the great Wisconsin Territory for the first time. And while she was thankful for the abundant blessings her family enjoyed because of Grandpa's legacy, the quiet young woman still felt like an outsider in Widow's Ridge. Distracted by Henrik's sticky fingers on her arm, Mara turned to help her baby brother with his glass of fresh buttermilk, and then returned to her brooding. Among the community, it was well known that Mara was not Ephraim's daughter, although she carried the Peterson name. The bronzed hue of her skin, and eyes so dark they almost obscured the pupil, marked Mara as an outsider, a foreigner, and an enemy. Unsettled by her thoughts, Mara shifted her forlorn gaze from the table to the window. The simple muslin curtains she'd helped her mother create over the winter were a bright addition to the windows that were so often shuttered during the coldest months. But when Mara caught movement, she straightened and focused on the group that dismounted in front of the trading post.
"Mama, there are trappers, and it looks like they've brought furs."
Em turned her head and observed the strangers as her husband joined her.
"I'm sure Dahlia will send Lula to fetch me if I'm needed to translate."
"Translate?" Flora questioned, anxious for any excitement that would break the monotony of caring for her little brothers.
"Who are they?"
Emmeline waved the question away and gestured everyone's attention back to their meal. The trading post was inundated every spring by the men who spent the cold months collecting the pellets of bear, beaver, fox, otter, and rabbits. And even though the number of furs had dwindled excessively since her father established the post, Emmeline was glad to see the trappers return year after year. Dahlia wasn't surprised by the group of braves, but she was astonished to find that three of the Indians spoke passable English.
"We were born here," Jean David explained to the woman. "But I am known as White Wolf among my mother's people."
"Whistler?"
Dahlia gasped.
"Oh my, you're one of Jean Edward's sons?"
Waving to her daughter Lula, Dahlia implored,
"Go find Emmeline."
The brave's face paled and he turned to those with him.
"She is here," he explained in their native tongue.
Migasi slowly pivoted, seeking out the woman who had deserted him as a child. Oh, he was well aware of the story his father told of that time, how a white woman would not be accepted among the gathering of the tribes. But his father's first wife, Dinadisi, often shared that she would never leave her children, no matter the cost. And so Migasi puzzled over his mother's abandonment. When the petite woman with porcelain skin and snapping blue eyes arrived, Migasi noted the flecks of gray in her raven black hair, and he recalled the softness of the curls he would swirl around his fingers as a small boy.
"Ni mama?"
Eyes going round, Emmeline clasped a hand over her heart.
"Little eagle?"
"I'm not little anymore, ni mama. I'm a man now."
Mara watched the exchange in disbelief. She knew that word.
Mother? This man called her mama mother? How could that be?
And then another of the braves stepped forward and Mara searched his face. Then she stood tall before his scrutiny.
"Who is this woman who stands along the edge?"
Amick demanded as Emmeline dropped her eyes and the girl before him gazed earnestly at his face.
"You may call her Gidanis, Amick, for she is the last gift you gave to me,"
Emmeline softly replied as she leaned into her warrior's embrace. July 1859. Widow's Ridge had changed in the 2 years since Mara's departure. The buzz of the sawmill and the scent of fresh-cut pine still filled the air. But there were more people, more businesses, and more stares as she rode through town. Her buckskin dress, the osprey feathers braided into her hair, and the paint pony she rode all spoke of her Ojibwe heritage. Although the intervening years with her father's tribe had not been what Mara hoped, it was still strange to ride into the place she'd lived most of her life and find it so different. A shrill whistle rent the air, and her horse danced sideways at the horrendous sound.
"Easy, Starbright,"
Mara gently cooed to the skittish animal.
"We're almost home."
And what a strange thought that was. Home. In all of her 16 years, Mara had never felt accepted. Not in her mother's log cabin or her father's village. And she'd certainly never been welcome in her husband's wigwam. Even though Amik had gifted her to the brave who saved her brother's life, Mara found scant joy in caring for the man who'd sacrificed himself for Migisi. Touching the strand of claws that adorned the bodice of her dress, Mara cringed to think of Namiki and all he'd endured after the bear attack. The damage to the brave's impressive body was nothing compared to the destruction of his sense of manhood. Her stepmother, Dina Disi, had been persuaded to help Mara learn the womanly arts of physical comfort. But Mara's efforts to soothe Namiki failed more than they succeeded, and the wounded brave would not be consoled.
"Don't dwell on it," her brother placated when he noticed the shudder that rippled through Mara's small frame.
"You paid my debt and conveyed honor to your husband by your actions."
"What will they say of me here, Migisi? I did not want to return, but Imbaba insisted. These people? They'll find me disgraced, just like they did with our mother. Although I do not carry a child with me, these people will still find me repugnant."
Migisi frowned and leapt from the back of his pony. Leading the horses to the water's edge, he let them drink while he focused on his sister's anguish. "You will go home to Nimama, and she will care for you. There's no shame for you, Mara, unless you bring it upon yourself." A sheen of tears covered Emmeline's eyes as she watched the two ponies approach the trading post. The forms were familiar, and she shouted with joy as her two oldest children rode into the yard.
"You're here!"
When he heard the commotion, Casper Bell darted from his barn, rifle in hand. Approaching the corner of the trading post, he drew a bead on the brave that restrained Emmeline. Shocked by the sudden lancing pain in his shoulder, Casper groaned. The gun began to shake, and his aim shifted as he fired. Screams erupted from Emmeline's throat as her son fell backward in a heap. The burn of the bullet as it grazed her cheek oozed blood, but the stunned mother dropped to her knees and cradled the lifeless body in her arms. Stunned by the horrific tableau, Mara drew her last weapon and threw it at the murderer. Her boning knife lodged deep in the man's bicep, not far from where her first blade landed. 14-year-old Elias and 12-year-old Liam appeared, skidding around the corner of the house as they came in from the fields. While the report of a rifle was a common occurrence in the woods around them, it was a highly unusual circumstance when it echoed from the area around their home and the family's trading post. The railroad spur to Widow's Ridge was only a few months old, but already an influx of immigrants, transients, and assorted riffraff made the boys wary. So when they spotted their new stepfather covered in blood and propped up against the edge of the building, the boys bolted for cover. When their mother's deep sobs reached Liam's ears, he peeked around the edge of the well.
"Mara!"
he urgently called when he noticed the other younger woman.
"Mara, is that you?" "Get Papa!"
she fearfully responded as she approached the bleeding stranger. Mara wanted to recoil when she grabbed the hot barrel of the man's rifle, but she refused to let go as she jerked the weapon from his grasp. Flipping the gun around, she aimed for his shiny, bald head.
"Mara, no!"
Elias screamed.
"Stop! He's Mama's husband!"
That evening, her Uncle Ezra's warm embrace was a balm to Mara's wounded soul.
I don't understand,
she hoarsely murmured, her voice ruined by a torrent of tears.
Papa went to be with Jesus,
her youngest brother, Hendrik, whimpered. Holding open her arms, she coaxed the little boy into her lap and gently rocked him until he settled. Ezra's daughter, Anna Rose, toddled over and lifted her arms to her father, and suddenly everyone was crowded around the wooden settee looking for comfort amid the tragedy. As Emmeline descended the stairs into the kitchen, the hushed voices of her family soothed something inside her. But instead of going to them to find solace for her grief, she stepped outside and looked up to the stars.
Father, please accept my boy's spirit into your presence. He was not taught about your son, but among his people, there is knowledge of you as the Creator. Please, please let that be enough. I want to see him again. I want to hold him and make up for all the years I missed in his life, she pleaded.
Sinking to the steps, Emmeline rested her elbows on her knees and dropped her head into her hands. Ezra watched and waited for several minutes before he stepped out onto the back porch. Casper is calling for you, Em, but I sent Liam up to tend him for a little bit.
Thank you.
Exhaling a pent-up breath, Ezra leaned against the porch railing and tried to reconcile the ways of his mother's people against those of his father's. His wife, Lula, had introduced him to the tenets of Christianity, and, in some ways, it melded with the spirituality held by the Ojibwa. Still, Ezra was faced with a dilemma between the cultures. How will you see Migisi in the afterlife, sister?
I don't know, she sighed. I cannot reconcile what I know of your customs against the practices of my own faith.
Then let me honor both, and when it is done, I'll return to Amik with the news.
What of Mara? Will you help her steal away again, Ezra?
Moving to sit beside the melancholy woman, Ezra clasped his palms around his knees and lengthened his spine. Stoic and unshakable, the brave quietly consoled. She has chosen to return. Like me, Mara finds herself caught between two worlds, and neither is a comfortable place. I stay because Lula is my home. Anna Rose, Chester, and the new child are my future. Now, it's time to help Mara find her anchor, sister. She needs your guidance.